The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I will read part two of the story we started last week, Raise High, The Roof Beam Carpenters by J.D. Salinger, the 10th one he published in the New Yorker magazine. Last week, the story began with the writer telling us about going to his brother's wedding in New York City in 1942. The writer knew no one there, and his brother Seymour never turned up. Finally, everyone headed for the reception anyway. The writer got into a car with some friends of the bride. The matron of honor was furious because Seymour had backed out at the last minute. She said he was a latent homosexual, according to hearsay. And now, part two of Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters, by J.D. Salinger, published in the November 19, 1955 issue of the New Yorker magazine. What else did she say? Mrs. Silburn asked. Rhea, I mean. Did she say anything else? I didn't look at her. I couldn't take my eyes off of the matron of honor's face. But I had a passing, wild impression that Mrs. Silburn was all but sitting in the main speaker's lap. No, not really. Hardly anything. The matron of honor, reflecting, shook her head. I mean, as I say, she wouldn't have said anything with people standing around and all, if poor Muriel hadn't been so crazy upset. She flicked her cigarette ashes again. About the only other thing she said was that this Seymour was a really schizoid personality and that if you really looked at it the right way, it was really better for Muriel that things turned out the way they did. Which makes sense to me, but I'm not so sure it does to Muriel. He's got her so buffaloed that she doesn't know whether she's coming or going. That's what makes me so... She was interrupted at that point by me. As I remember, my voice was unsteady, as it invariably is when I'm vastly upset. What brought Mrs. Fetter to the conclusion that Seymour is a latent homosexual and a schizoid personality? All eyes. All searchlights, it seemed. The matron of honors, Mrs. Silburn's, even the lieutenants were abruptly trained on me. What? The matron of honor said to me, sharply, faintly, hostily. And again I had a passing abrasive notion that she knew I was Seymour's brothers. What makes Mrs. Fetter think that Seymour's a latent homosexual and a schizoid personality? The matron of honor stared at me and then gave an eloquent snort. She turned and appealed to Mrs. Silburn with a maxim of irony. Would you say that somebody's normal that pulled a stunt like that one today? She raised her eyebrows and waited. Would you? She asked quietly, quietly. Be honest, I'm just asking for this gentleman's benefit. Mrs. Silburn's answer was gentleness itself, fairness itself. No, I certainly would not, she said. I had a sudden, violent impulse to jump out of the car and break into a sprint in any direction at all. As I remember, though, I was still in my jump seat when the matron of honor addressed me again. Look, she said in the spuriously patient tone of voice that a teacher might take with a child who's not only retarded but whose nose is forever running unattractively. I don't know how much you know about people, but what man in his right mind, the night before he's supposed to get married, keeps his fiancée up all night, blabbing to her all about how he's too happy to get married, and that she'll have to postpone the wedding till he feels steadier, or he won't be able to come to it. Then, when his fiancée explains to him, like a child, that everything's been arranged and planned out for months, and that her father's gone to incredible expense and trouble, and all to have a reception and everything like that, and that her relatives and friends are coming from all over the country. Then, after she explains all of that, he says to her he's terribly sorry, but he can't get married till he feels less happy or some crazy thing. Use your head now, if you don't mind. Does that sound like somebody normal? Does that sound like somebody in their right mind? Her voice was now shrill. Or does that sound like somebody that should be stuck in some booby hatch? She looked at me very severely, and when I didn't immediately speak up either in defense or surrender, she sat heavily back in her seat and said to her husband, "Give me another cigarette, please. This thing's gonna burn me." She handed him her burning stub, and he extinguished it for her. He then took out his cigarette package again. "You light it," she said. "I haven't got the energy." Mrs. Silsburn cleared her throat. "It sounds to me," she said, "like a blessing in disguise that everything's turned." "I ask you," the matron of honor said to her with a fresh impetus, at the same time accepting a freshly lighted cigarette from her husband, "does that sound like a normal person, a normal man to you? Or does it sound like somebody that's either never grown up, or it's just an absolute raving maniac of some crazy kind?" "Goodness, I don't know what to say, really. It just sounds to me like a blessing in disguise that every..." The matron of honor sat forward suddenly, alertly exhaling smoke through her nostrils. "All right, never mind that. Drop that for a minute. I don't need that," she said. She was addressing Mrs. Silsburn, but in actuality she was addressing me through Mrs. Silsburn's face, so to speak. "Did you ever see in the movies?" she demanded. The name she mentioned was the professional name of a then fairly well-known and now in 55, a quite famous actress-singer. "Yes," said Mrs. Silsburn quickly and interestedly, and waited. The matron of honor nodded. "All right," she said. "Did you ever notice by any chance how she smiles sort of crooked? Only one side of her face, sort of? It's very noticeable if you..." "Yes, yes, I have," said Mrs. Silsburn. The matron of honor dragged on her cigarette and glanced over, just perceptibly, at me. "Well, that happens to be a partial paralysis of some kind," she said, exhaling a little gust of smoke with each word. "And do you know how she got it? This normal Seymour person apparently hit her, and she had 9 stitches taken in her face." She reached over, in lieu possibly of a better stage direction, and flicked her ashes again. "May I ask where you heard that?" I said. My lips were quivering slightly like two fools. "You may," she said, looking at Mrs. Silsburn instead of me. "Muriel's mother happened to mention it about 2 hours ago while Muriel was sobbing her eyes out." She looked at me. "Does that answer your question?" She suddenly shifted her bouquet of gardenias from her right to her left hand. It was the nearest thing to a fairly commonplace nervous gesture that I'd seen her make. "Just for your information, incidentally," she said, looking at me, "do you know who I think you are? I think you're this Seymour's brother." She waited very briefly, and when I didn't say anything, "You look like him from his crazy picture, and I happen to know that he was supposed to come to the wedding. His sister or somebody told Muriel." Her look was fixed unwaveringly on my face. "Are you?" she asked bluntly. My voice must have sounded a trifle rented when I answered, "Yes," I said. My face was burning. In a way, though, I felt an infinitely less furry sense of self-identification than I had since I'd got off the train earlier in the afternoon. "I knew you were," the matron of honor said. "I'm not stupid, you know. I know who you were the minute you got in this car." And she turned to her husband. "Didn't I say he was his brother the minute he got in this car? Didn't I?" The lieutenant altered his sitting position a trifle. "Well, you said he probably..." "Yes, you did," he said. "You did, yes." One didn't have to look over at Mrs. Silsburn to perceive how attentively she had taken in this latest development. I glanced past and behind her, furtively, at the fifth passenger, the tiny elderly man, to see if his insularity was still intact. It was. No one's indifference has ever been such a comfort to me. The matron of honor came back to me. For your information, I also know that your brother's no chiropodist, so don't be so funny. I happen to know he was Billy Black on It's a Wise Child for about 50 years or something. Mrs. Silsburn abruptly took a more active part in the conversation. The radio program? She inquired, and I felt her looking at me with a fresh, keener interest. The matron of honor didn't answer her. Which one were you? She said to me. Georgie Black? The mixture of rudeness and curiosity in her voice was interesting, if not quite disarming. Georgie Black was my brother Walt, I said, answering only her second question. She turned to Mrs. Silsburn. It's supposed to be some kind of a secret or something, but this man and his brother Seymour were on this radio program under fake names or something. The Black Children. Take it easy, honey, take it easy, the lieutenant suggested rather nervously. His wife turned to him. I will not take it easy, she said. And again, contrary to my every conscious inclination, I felt a little pinch of something close to admiration for her metal, solid brass, or no. His brother's supposed to be so intelligent, for heaven's sake, she said. In college when he was 14 or something and all like that. If what he did to that kid today is intelligent, then I'm Mahatma Gandhi. I don't care. It just makes me sick. Just then I felt a minute extra added discomfort. Someone was very closely examining the left or weaker side of my face. It was Mrs. Silsburn. She started a bit as I turned abruptly toward her. May I ask you if you were Buddy Black? She said, and a certain deferential note in her voice rather made me think for a fractional moment that she was about to present me with a fountain pen and a small Morocco-bound autograph album. The passing thought made me distinctly uneasy. Considering, if nothing else, the fact that it was 1942 and some 9 or 10 years past my commercial bloom. The reason I ask, she said, my husband used to listen to that program without fail every single... If you're interested, the matron of honor interrupted her, looking at me, that was the one program on the air I always absolutely loathed. I loathe precocious children. If I ever had a child that... The end of her sentence was lost to us. She was interrupted, suddenly and unequivocally, by the most piercing, most deafening, most impure E-flat blast I've ever heard. All of us in the car, I'm sure, literally jumped. At that moment, a drum and bugle corps, composed of what seemed to be 100 or more tone-deaf Sea Scouts, was passing. With what seemed to be almost delinquent abandon, the boys had just rammed into the sides of the Stars and Stripes Forever. Mrs. Silsburn very sensibly clapped her hands over her ears. For an eternity of seconds, it seemed, the din was all but incredible. Only the matron of honor's voice could have risen above it, or, for that matter, would have attempted to. When it did, one might have thought she was addressing us, obviously at the top of her voice, from some great distance away, somewhere possibly in the vicinity of the bleachers of Yankee Stadium. I can't take this, she said. Let's get out of here and find some place to phone from. I've got to phone Muriel and say we're delayed. She'll be crazy. With the advent of the local Armageddon, Mrs. Silsburn and I had faced front to see it in. We now turned around, again in our jump seats, to face the leader, and possibly our deliverer. There's a Schraff's on 79th Street, she bellowed at Mrs. Silsburn. Let's go have a soda, and I can phone from there. It'll at least be air-conditioned. Mrs. Silsburn nodded enthusiastically and pantomimed yes with her mouth. You come too, the matron of honor shouted at me. With very peculiar spontaneity, I remember, I shouted back to her the altogether extravagant word, fine. It isn't easy to this day to account for the matron of honors having included me in her invitation to quit the ship. It may simply have been inspired by a born leader's natural sense of orderliness. She may have had some sort of remote but compulsive urge to make her landing party complete. My singularly immediate acceptance of the invitation strikes me as much more easily explainable. I prefer to think it was a basically religious impulse. In certain Zen monasteries, it's a cardinal rule, if not the only serious enforced discipline, that when one monk calls out "Hi" to the other monk, the latter must call back "Hi" without thinking. The matron of honor then turned and, for the first time, directly addressed the tiny elderly man beside her. To my undying gratification, he was still glaring straight ahead of him as though his own private scenery hadn't changed an iota. His unlighted, clear Havana cigar was still clenched between two fingers. What with his apparent unmindfulness of the terrible din the passing drum and bugle corps was making, and possibly from a grim tenet that all old men over 80 must be either stone deaf or very hard of hearing, the matron of honor brought her lips to within an inch or two of his left ear. "We're going to get out of the car," she shouted at him, almost into him. "We're going to find a place to phone from and maybe have some refreshment. Do you want to come with us?" The elderly man's immediate reaction was just short of glorious. He looked first at the matron of honor, then at the rest of us, and then grinned. It was a grin that was no less resplendent for the fact that it made no sense whatever, nor for the fact that his teeth were obviously beautifully, transcendently false. He looked at the matron of honor inquisitively for just an instant, his grin wonderfully in. Or rather, he looked to her as if, I thought, he believed the matron of honor, or one of us, had lovely plans to pass a picnic basket his way. "I don't think he heard you, honey," the lieutenant shouted. The matron of honor nodded and once again brought the megaphone of her mouth up close to the old man's ear. With really praiseworthy volume, she repeated her invitation to the old man to join us in quitting the car. Once again, at face value, the old man seemed more than amenable to any suggestion in the world, possibly not short of trotting over and having a dip in the East River. But again, too, one had an uneasy conviction that he hadn't heard a word that was said to him. Abruptly, he proved that this was true. With an enormous grin at all of us collectively, he raised his cigar hand and, with one finger, significantly tapped first his mouth and then his ear. The gesture, as he made it, seemed related to a perfectly first-class joke of some kind that he fully meant to share with all of us. At that moment, Mrs. Silsburn, beside me, gave a visible little sign, almost a jump of comprehension. She touched the matron of honor's pink satin arm and shouted, "I know who he is! He's deaf and dumb! He's a deaf mute! He's Muriel's father's uncle!" The matron of honor's lips formed the word, "Oh." She swung around in her seat toward her husband. "You got a paper and a pencil?" she bellowed to him. I touched her arm and shouted that I had. Hastily, almost, in fact, for some reason, as though time were about to run out on all of us, I took out of my inside tunic pocket a small pad and a pencil stub that I'd recently acquisitioned from a desk drawer of my company orderly room at Fort Benning. Somewhat over-legibly, I wrote on a sheet of paper, "We're held up indefinitely by the parade. We're going to find a phone and have a cold drink somewhere. Will you join us?" I folded the paper once and then handed it to the matron of honor, who opened it, read it, and then handed it to the tiny old man. He read it, grinning, and then looked at me and wagged his head up and down several times, vehemently. I thought for an instant that this was the full and perfectly eloquent extent of his reply, but he suddenly motioned to me with his hand, and I gathered that he wanted me to pass him my pad and pencil. I did so, without looking over at the matron of honor, from whom waves of impatience were rising. The old man adjusted the pad and pencil on his lap with the greatest care, and then sat for a moment, pencil poised in obvious concentration. His grin diminished only a very trifle. Then the pencil began, very unsteadily, to move. and I was dotted. And then both pad and pencil were returned personally to me with a marvelously cordial extra added wag of the head. He had written, in letters that had not quite gelled yet, the single word, delighted. The matron of honor, reading over my shoulder, gave a sound faintly like a snort, but I quickly looked over at the great writer and tried to show by my expression that all of us in the car knew a poem when we saw one and were grateful. One by one, then, from both doors, we all got out of the car, abandoned ship, as it were, in the middle of Madison Avenue, in a sea of hot, gummy macadam. The lieutenant lingered behind a moment to inform the driver of our mutiny. As I remember very well, the drum and bugle corps was still endlessly passing, and the din hadn't abated a bit. The matron of honor and Mrs. Silsburn led the way to Schraff's. They walked as a twosome, almost as advance scouts, south on the east side of Madison Avenue. When he'd finished briefing the driver, the lieutenant caught up with them, or almost up with them. He fell a little behind them in order to take out his wallet in privacy and see, apparently, how much money he had with him. The bride's father's uncle and I brought up the rear. Whether he had intuited that I was his friend or simply because I was the owner of a pad and pencil, he had rather more scrambled than gravitated to a walking position beside me. The very top of his beautiful silk hat didn't come up as high as my shoulder. I set a comparatively slow gait for us, in deference to the length of his legs. At the end of a block or so, we were quite a good distance behind the others. I don't think it troubled either of us. Occasionally, I remember, as we walked along, my friend and I looked up and down, respectively, at each other and exchanged idiotic expressions of pleasure at sharing one another's company. When my companion and I reached the revolving door of Schraff's 79th Street, the matron of honor, her husband, and Mrs. Silsburn had all been standing there for some minutes. They were waiting, I thought, as a rather forbiddingly integrated party of three. They had been talking, but they stopped when our motley twosome approached. In the car, just a couple of minutes earlier when the drum and bugle corps blasted by, a common discomfort, almost a common anguish, had lent our small group a semblance of alliance, of the sort that can be temporarily conferred on Cook's tourists caught in a very heavy rainstorm at Pompeii. All too clearly now, as the tiny old man and I reached the revolving door of Schraff's, the storm was over. The matron of honor and I exchanged expressions of recognition, not of greeting. "It's close for alterations," she stated coldly, looking at me. Unofficially, but unmistakably, she was appointing me odd man out again, and at that moment, for no reason worth going into, I felt a sense of isolation and loneliness more overwhelming than I'd felt all day. Somewhat simultaneously, it's worth noting, my cough reactivated itself. I pulled my handkerchief out of my hip pocket. The matron of honor turned to Mrs. Silsburn and her husband. "There's a Longchamps around here somewhere," she said, "but I don't know where." "I don't know either," Mrs. Silsburn said. She seemed very close to tears. At both her forward head and her upper lip, perspiration had seeped through even her heavy pancake makeup. A black patent leather handbag was under her left arm. She held it as though it were a favorite doll, and she herself an experimentally rouged and powdered and very unhappy runaway child. "We're not going to be able to get a cab for love or money," the lieutenant said pessimistically. He was looking the worse for wear, too. His hot pilot's cap appeared almost cruelly incongruous on his pale, dripping, deeply unintrepid-looking face, and I remember having an impulse to whisk it off his head, or at least to straighten it somewhat, to adjust it into a less cocked position. The same impulse in general motive that one might feel at a children's party, where there is invariably one small, exceedingly homely child wearing a paper hat that crushes down one or both ears. "Oh, God, what a day!" the matron of honor said for all of us. Her circlet of artificial flowers was somewhat askew, and she was thoroughly damp, but I thought the only thing really destructible about her was her remotest appendage, so to speak, her gardenia bouquet. She was still holding it, however absent-mindedly, in her hand. It obviously hadn't stood the gaff. "What will we do?" she said, rather frantically. "We can't walk there. They live practically in Riverdale. Does anybody have any bright ideas?" She looked first at Mrs. Silsburn, then at her husband, and then, in desperation possibly, at me. "I have an apartment near here," I said suddenly and nervously. "It's just down the block, as a matter of fact." I have a feeling that I gave out this information a trifle too loudly. I may even have shouted it for all I know. "It belongs to my brother and me. My sister's using it while we're in the army, but she's not there now. She's in the waves, and she's off on some trip." I looked at the matron of honor, or at some point just over her head. "You can at least phone from there if you like," I said, "and the apartment's air-conditioned. We might all cool off for a minute and get our breaths." When the first shock of the invitation had passed over, the matron of honor, Mrs. Silsburn, and the lieutenant went into a sort of consultation of eyes only. But there was no visible sign that any kind of verdict was forthcoming. The matron of honor was the first to take any kind of action. She'd been looking, in vain, at the other two for an opinion on the subject. She turned back to me and said, "Did you say you had a phone?" "Yes, unless my sister's had it disconnected for some reason, and I can't see why she would have." "How do we know your brother won't be there?" the matron of honor said. It was a small consideration that hadn't entered my overheated head. "I don't think he will be," I said. "He may be. It's his apartment, too, but I don't think he will. I really don't." The matron of honor stared at me openly for a moment, and not really rudely for a change, unless children's stares are rude. Then she turned back to her husband and Mrs. Silsburn and said, "We might as well. At least we can phone." They nodded in agreement. Mrs. Silsburn, in fact, went so far as to remember her code of etiquette covering invitations given in front of Schraff's. Through her sun-baked pancake makeup, a semblance of an Emily Post smile peeped out at me. It was very welcome, as I remember. "Come on, then. Let's get out of this sun," our leader said. "What'll I do with this?" She didn't wait for an answer. She stepped over to the curb and unsentimentally disengaged herself from her wilted gardenia bouquet. "Okay, lead on, McDuff," she said to me. "We'll follow you. And all I have to say is he'd better not be there when we get there, or I'll kill him." She looked at Mrs. Silsburn. "Excuse my language, but I mean it." As directed, I took the lead almost happily. An instant later, a silk hat materialized in the air beside me, considerably down and at the left, and my special, only technically unassigned cohort grinned up at me. For a moment, I rather thought he was going to slip his hand into mine. My three guests and my one friend remained outside in the hall while I briefly cased the apartment. The windows were all closed. The two air conditioners had been turned to shut, and the first breath one took was rather like inhaling deeply in someone's ancient raccoon coat pocket. The only sound in the whole apartment was the somewhat trembling purr of the aged refrigerator Seymour and I had acquired secondhand. My sister Boo Boo, in her girlish naval way, had left it turned on. There were, in fact, throughout the apartment, any number of little untidy signs that a seafaring lady had taken over the place. A handsome, small-size ensign's navy blue jacket was flung lining down across the couch. A box of Lewis Sherry candies, half empty, and with the unconsumed candies all more or less experimentally squeezed, was open on the coffee table in front of the couch. A framed photograph of a very resolute-looking young man I'd never seen before stood on the desk. And all the ashtrays in sight were in full blossom with crumpled facial tissues and lipsticked cigarette ends. I didn't go into the kitchen, the bedroom, or the bathroom, except to open the doors and take a quick look to see if Seymour was standing upright anywhere. For one reason, I felt enervated and lazy. For another, I was kept pretty busy raising blinds, turning on air conditioners, emptying loaded ashtrays. Besides, the other members of the party barged in on me almost immediately. "It's hotter in here than it is on the street," the matron of honor said, by way of greeting, as she strode in. "I'll be with you in just a minute," I said. "I can't seem to get this air conditioner to work." The on button seemed to be stuck, in fact, and I was busily tinkering with it. While I worked on the air conditioner switch, with my hat still on my head, I remember, the others circulated rather suspiciously around the room. I watched them out of the corner of one eye. The lieutenant went over to the desk and stood looking up at the 3 or 4 square feet of wall directly above it, where my brother and I, for defiantly sentimental reasons, had tacked up a number of glossy 8x10 photographs. Mrs. Silburn sat down, inevitably, I thought, in the one chair in the room that my deceased Boston Bull used to enjoy sleeping in. Its arms, upholstered in dirty corduroy, had been thoroughly slavered and chewed on in the course of many a nightmare. The bride's father's uncle, my great friend, seemed to have disappeared completely. The matron of honor, too, seemed suddenly to be somewhere else. "I'll get you all something to drink in just a second," I said uneasily, still trying to force the switch button on the air conditioner. "I could use something cold to drink," said a very familiar voice. I turned around and saw that she had stretched herself out on the couch, which accounted for her noticeable vertical disappearance. "I'll use your phone in just a second," she advised me. "I couldn't open my mouth anyway to talk on the phone in this condition. I'm so parched. My tongue's so dry." The air conditioner abruptly whirred into operation, and I came over to the middle of the room, into the space between the couch and the chair where Mrs. Silburn was sitting. "I don't know what there is to drink," I said. "I haven't looked in the refrigerator, but I imagine..." "Bring anything," the eternal spokeswoman interrupted from the couch. "Just make it wet and cold." The heels of her shoes were resting on the sleeve of my sister's jacket. Her hands were folded across her chest. A pillow was hunched up under her head. "Put ice in it, if you have any," she said, and closed her eyes. I looked down at her for a brief but murderous instant, then bent over and, as tactfully as possible, eased Boo Boo's jacket out from under her feet. I started to leave the room and go about my chores as host, but just as I took a step, the lieutenant spoke up from over at the desk. "Where'd you get all these pictures?" he said. I went directly over to him. I was still wearing my visored, oversized garrison cap. It hadn't occurred to me to take it off. I stood beside him at the desk, and yet a trifle behind him, and looked up at the photographs on the wall. I said they were mostly old photographs of the children who had been on It's a Wise Child in the days when Seymour and I had been on the show. The lieutenant turned to me. "What was it?" he said. "I never heard of it. One of those kids' quiz shows? Questions and answers and like that?" Unmistakably, a soupçon of army rank had slipped unnoisily but insidiously into his voice. He also seemed to be looking at my hat. I took off my hat and said, "No, not exactly." A certain amount of low family pride was suddenly evoked. It was before my brother Seymour was on it, and it more or less got that way again after he went off the program. But he changed the whole format, really. He turned the program into a kind of children's roundtable discussion. The lieutenant looked at me with, I thought, somewhat excessive interest. "Were you on it, too?" "Yes." The matron of honor spoke up from the other side of the room, from the invisible, dusty recesses of the couch. "I'd like to see a kid of mine get on one of those crazy programs," she said, "or act. Any of those things. I'd die, in fact, before I'd let any child of mine turn himself into a little exhibitionist before the public. It warps their whole entire lives. The publicity and all, if nothing else, ask any psychiatrist. I mean, how can you have any kind of a normal childhood or anything?" Her head, crowned in a now lopsided circlet of flowers, suddenly popped into view. As though disembodied, it perched on the catwalk of the back of the couch, facing the lieutenant and me. That's probably what's the matter with that brother of yours, the head said. I mean, you lead an absolutely freakish life like that when you're a kid, and so naturally you never learn to grow up. You never learn to relate to normal people or anything. That's exactly what Mrs. Fetter was saying in that crazy bedroom a couple of hours ago. But exactly. Your brother's never learned to relate to anybody. All he can do, apparently, is go around giving people a bunch of stitches in their faces. He's absolutely unfit for marriage or anything halfway normal, for goodness sake. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what Mrs. Fetter said. The head then turned just enough to glare over at the lieutenant. Am I right, Bob? Did she or didn't she say that? Tell the truth. The next voice to speak up was not the lieutenant's, but mine. My mouth was dry and my groin felt damp. I said I didn't give a good goddamn what Mrs. Fetter had to say on the subject of Seymour, or, for that matter, what any professional dilettante or amateur B-word had to say. I said that from the time Seymour was 10 years old, every summa cum laude thinker and intellectual men's room attendant in the country had been having a go at him. I said it might be different if Seymour had just been some nasty little high IQ show-off. I said he hadn't ever been an exhibitionist. He went down to the broadcast every Wednesday night as though he were going to his own funeral. He didn't even talk to you, for God's sake, the whole way down on the bus or subway. I said not one goddamn person of all the patronizing fourth-rate critics and column writers had ever seen him for what he really was. A poet, for God's sake. And I meant a poet. If he never wrote a line of poetry, he could still flash what he had at you with the back of his ear if he wanted to. I stopped right there, thank God. My heart was banging away something terrible. And like most hypochondriacs, I had a little passing, intimidating notion that such speeches were the stuff that heart attacks are made of. To this day, I have no idea at all how my guests reacted to my outbreak, the polluted little stream of invective I loosed on them. The first real exterior detail that I was aware of was the universally familiar sound of plumbing. It came from another part of the apartment. I looked around the room suddenly, between and through and past the immediate faces of my guests. "Where's the old man?" I asked. "The little old man." Butter wouldn't have melted in my mouth. Oddly enough, when an answer came, it came from the lieutenant, not the matron of honor. "I believe he's in the bathroom," he said. The statement was issued with a special forthrightness, proclaiming the speaker to be one of those who don't mince everyday hygienic facts. "Oh," I said. I looked rather absently around the room again. Whether or not I deliberately avoided meeting the matron of honor's terrible eye, I don't remember, or don't care to remember. I spotted the bride's father's uncle's silk hat on the seat of a straight chair across the room. I had an impulse to say hello aloud to it. "I'll get some cold drinks," I said. "I'll just be a minute."
"May I use your phone?"
the matron of honor suddenly said to me as I passed by the couch. She swung her feet to the floor. "Yes, yes, of course," I said. I looked at Mrs. Silsburn and the lieutenant. "I thought I'd make some Tom Collinses if there are any lemons or limes. Will that be all right?" The lieutenant's answer startled me by its sudden conviviality. "Bring 'em on," he said, and rubbed his hands together like a hearty drinking man. Mrs. Silsburn left off studying the photographs over the desk to advise me, "If you're going to make Tom Collinses, please just a teensy, teensy little bit of gin in mine. Almost none at all, if it isn't too much trouble." She was beginning to look a bit recuperated, even in just the short time since we'd got off the street. Perhaps, for one reason, because she was standing within a few feet of the air conditioner I'd turned on, and some cool air was coming her way. I said I'd look out for her drink, and then left her among the minor radio celebrities of the early 30s and late 20s, the many passé little faces of Seymour's and my boyhood. The lieutenant seemed well able to shift for himself in my absence, too. He was already moving, hands joined behind his back like a lone connoisseur toward the bookshelves. The matron of honor followed me out of the room, yawning as she did, a cavernous, audible yawn that she made no effort to suppress or obstruct from view. As the matron of honor followed me toward the bedroom, where the phone was, the bride's father's uncle came toward us from the far end of the hall. His face was in the ferocious repose that had fooled me during most of the car ride, but as he came closer to us in the hall, the mask reversed itself. He pantomimed to us both the very highest salutations and greetings, and I found myself grinning and nodding immoderately in return. His sparse white hair looked freshly combed, almost freshly washed, as though he might have discovered a tiny barbershop cached away at the other end of the apartment. When he'd passed us, I felt a compulsion to look back over my shoulder, and when I did, he waved to me vigorously, a great bon voyage, come back soon wave. It picked me up no end. "What is he, crazy?" the matron of honor said. I said I hoped so, and opened the door of the bedroom. She sat down heavily on one of the twin beds, Seymour's, as a matter of fact. The phone was on the night table within easy reach. I said I'd bring her a drink right away. "Don't bother. I'll be right out," she said. "Just close the door if you don't mind. I don't mean it that way, but I can never talk on the phone unless the door's closed." I told her I was the exact same way and started to leave. But just as I'd turned to come out of the space between the two beds, I noticed a small collapsible canvas valise over on the window seat. At first glance, I thought it was mine, miraculously arrived at the apartment all the way from Penn Station under its own steam. My second thought was that it must be Boo Boo's. I walked over to it. It was unzipped, and just one look at the top layer of its contents told me who the real owner was. With another, more inclusive look, I saw something lying on top of two laundered suntan shirts that I thought ought not to be left alone in the room with the matron of honor. I picked it out of the bag, slipped it under one arm, waved fraternally to the matron of honor, who had already inserted a finger into the first hole of the number she intended to dial, and was waiting for me to clear out, and then I closed the door behind me. I stood for some little time outside the bedroom, in the gracious solitude of the hall, wondering what to do with Seymour's diary, which, I ought to rush to say, was the object I'd picked out of the top of the canvas bag. My first constructive thought was to hide it till my guests had left. It seemed to me a good idea to take it into the bathroom and drop it into the laundry hamper. However, on a second and much more involved train of thought, I decided to take it into the bathroom and read parts of it, and then drop it into the laundry hamper. It was a day, God knows, not only of rampant signs and symbols, but of wildly extensive communication via the written word. If you jumped into crowded cars, fate took circuitous pains. Before you did any jumping, that you had a pad and pencil with you, just in case one of your fellow passengers was a deaf mute. If you slipped into bathrooms, you did well to look up to see if there were any little messages, faintly apocalyptical or otherwise, posted high over the washbowl. For years, among the seven children in our one-bathroom family, it was our perhaps cloying but serviceable custom to leave messages for one another on the medicine cabinet mirror, using a moist sliver of soap to write with. The general theme of our messages usually ran to excessively strong admonitions and, not infrequently, undisguised threats. "Boo Boo, pick up your washcloth when you're done with it. Don't leave it on the floor. Love, Seymour. Walt, your turn to take Z and F to the park. I did it yesterday. Guess who? Wednesday is their anniversary. Don't go to movies or hang around to the studio after broadcast or pay forfeit. This means you too, buddy. Mother said Zoe nearly ate the Phenolax. Don't leave slightly poisonous objects on the sink that he can reach and eat." These, of course, are samples straight out of our childhood. But years later, when, in the name of independence or what have you, Seymour and I branched out and took an apartment of our own, he and I had not more than nominally departed from the old family custom. That is, we didn't just throw away our old soap fragments. When I checked into the bathroom with Seymour's diary under my arm and had carefully secured the door behind me, I spotted a message almost immediately. It was not, however, in Seymour's handwriting, but unmistakably in my sister Boo Boo's. With or without soap, her handwriting was always almost indecipherably minute, and she had easily managed to post the following message up on the mirror. Raise high the roof beam, carpenters. Like Ares comes the bridegroom, taller far than a tall man. Love, Irving Sappho, formerly under contract to Elysium Studios Limited. Please be happy, happy, happy with your beautiful Muriel. This is an order. I outrank everybody on this block. The contract writer quoted in the text, I might mention, has always been a great favorite at appropriately staggered time intervals with all the children in our family, largely through the immeasurable impact of Seymour's taste in poetry on all of us. I read and reread the quotation, and then I sat down on the edge of the bathtub and opened Seymour's diary. What follows is an exact reproduction of the pages from Seymour's diary that I read while I was sitting on the edge of the bathtub. It seems perfectly orderly to me to leave out individual datelines. Suffice it to say, I think, all these entries were made while he was stationed at Fort Monmouth in late 1941 and early 1942, some several months before the wedding date was set. It was freezing cold at retreat parade this evening, and yet about six men from our platoon alone fainted during the endless playing of the Star Spangled Banner. I suppose if your blood circulation is normal, you can't take the unnatural military position of attention, especially if you're holding a leaden rifle up at present arms. I have no circulation, no pulse. Immobility is my home. The tempo of the Star Spangled Banner and I are in perfect understanding. To me, its rhythm is a romantic waltz. We got passes till midnight after the parade. I met Muriel at the Biltmore at 7. Two drinks, two drugstore tuna fish sandwiches, then a movie she wanted to see, something with Greer Garson in it. I looked at her several times in the dark when Greer Garson's son's plane was missing in action. Her mouth was open, absorbed, worried. The identification with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer tragedy complete, I felt awe and happiness. How I love and need her undiscriminating heart. She looked over at me when the children in the picture brought in the kitten to show to their mother. M loved the kitten and wanted me to love it. Even in the dark, I could sense that she felt the usual estrangement from me when I don't automatically love what she loves. Later, when we were having a drink at the station, she asked me if I didn't think that kitten was rather nice. She doesn't use the word cute anymore. When did I ever frighten her out of her normal vocabulary? Bore that I am, I mentioned R.H. Blythe's definition of sentimentality, that we are being sentimental when we give to a thing more tenderness than God gives to it. I said, sententiously, that God undoubtedly loves kittens, but not in all probability with technicolor booties on their paws. He leaves that creative touch to scriptwriters. M thought this over, seemed to agree with me, but the knowledge wasn't too very welcome. She sat stirring her drink and feeling unclose to me. She worries over the way her love for me comes and goes, appears and disappears. She doubts its reality simply because it isn't as steadily pleasurable as a kitten. God knows it is sad. The human voice conspires to desecrate everything on earth. Dinner tonight at the Fetters. Very good. Veal, mashed potatoes, lima beans, a beautiful oil and vinegar green salad. For dessert, there was something Muriel made herself, a kind of frozen cream cheese affair with raspberries on it. It made tears come to my eyes. Saigyo says, what it is I know not, but with the gratitude my tears fall. A bottle of ketchup was placed on the table near me. Muriel had apparently told Mrs. Fetter that I put ketchup on everything. I'd give the world to have seen M telling her mother defensively that I put ketchup even on string beans. My precious girl. After dinner, Mrs. Fetter suggested we listen to the program. her enthusiasm, her nostalgia for the program, especially for the old days when Buddy and I were on it, make me uneasy. Tonight, it was broadcast from some naval airbase of all places near San Diego. Much too many pedantic questions and answers. Franny sounded as though she had a head cold. Zoe was in a dreamy top form. The announcer had them off on the subject of housing developments, and the little Burke girl said she hated houses that all look alike, meaning a long row of identical development houses. Zoe said they were nice. He said it would be very nice to come home and be in the wrong house, to eat dinner with the wrong people by mistake, sleep in the wrong bed by mistake, and kiss everybody goodbye in the morning thinking they were your own family. He said he even wished everybody in the world looked exactly alike. He said you'd keep thinking everybody you met was your wife or your mother or your father, and people would always be throwing their arms around each other wherever they went, and it would look very nice. I felt unbearably happy all evening. The familiarity between Muriel and her mother struck me as being so beautiful when we were all sitting in the living room. They know each other's weaknesses, especially conversational weaknesses, and pick at them with their eyes. Mrs. Fetter's eyes watch over Muriel's conversational taste in literature, and Muriel's eyes watch over her mother's tendency to be windy and verbose. When they argue, there can be no danger of a permanent rift because they're mother and daughter. A terrible and beautiful phenomenon to watch. Yet, there are times when I sit there enchanted that I wish Mr. Fetter were more conversationally active. Sometimes I felt I need him. Sometimes, in fact, when I come in the front door, it's like entering a kind of untidy, secular, two-woman convent. Sometimes when I leave, I have a peculiar feeling that both M and her mother have stuffed my pockets with little bottles and tubes containing lipstick, rouge, hairnets, deodorants, and so on. I feel overwhelmingly grateful to them, but I don't know what to do with their invisible gifts. We didn't get our passes directly after retreat this evening because someone dropped his rifle while the visiting British general was making his inspection. I missed the 5:52 and was an hour late meeting Muriel. Dinner at Lunfar's on 58th. M, irritable and tearful throughout dinner, genuinely upset and scared. Her mother thinks I'm a schizoid personality. Apparently, she's spoken to her psychoanalyst about me, and he agrees with her. Mrs. Fetter has asked Muriel to find out discreetly if there's any insanity in the family. I gather that Muriel was naive enough to tell her where I got the scars on my wrists, poor sweet baby. From what Muriel says, however, this doesn't bother her mother nearly so much as a couple of other things. Three other things. One, I withdraw from and fail to relate to people. Two, apparently there is something wrong with me because I haven't seduced Muriel. Three, evidently, Mrs. Fetter has been haunted for days by my remark at dinner one night that I'd like to be a dead cat. She asked me at dinner last week what I intended to do after I got out of the Army. Did I intend to resume teaching at the same college? Would I go back to teaching at all? Would I consider going back on the radio, possibly as a commentator of some kind? I answered that it seemed to me that the war might go on forever, and that I was only certain that if peace ever came again, I would like to be a dead cat. Mrs. Fetter thought I was cracking a joke of some kind, a sophisticated joke. She thinks I'm very sophisticated, according to Muriel. She thought my deadly serious comment was the sort of joke one ought to acknowledge with a light, musical laugh. When she laughed, I suppose it distracted me a little, and I forgot to explain to her. I told Muriel tonight that in Zen Buddhism, a master was once asked what was the most valuable thing in the world, and the master answered that a dead cat was, because no one could put a price on it. M was relieved, but I could see she could hardly wait to get home to assure her mother of the harmlessness of my remark. She rode to the station with me in the cab. How sweet she was, and in so much better humor. She was trying to teach me to smile. spreading the muscles around my mouth with her fingers. How beautiful it is to see her laugh. Oh, God, I'm so happy with her. If only she could be happier with me. I amuse her at times, and she seems to like my face and hands and the back of my head, and she gets a vast satisfaction out of telling her friends that she's engaged to the Billy Black who was on It's a Wise Child for years. And I think she feels a mixed maternal and sexual drive in my general direction. But on the whole, I don't make her really happy. Oh, God, help me. My one terrible consolation is that my beloved has an undying, basically undeviating love for the institution of marriage itself. She has a primal urge to play house permanently. Her marital goals are so absurd and touching. She wants to get a very dark suntan and go up to the desk clerk in some very posh hotel and ask if her husband has picked up the mail yet. She wants to shop for curtains. She wants to shop for maternity clothes. She wants to get out of her mother's house, whether she knows it or not. And, despite her attachment to her, she wants children, good-looking children with her features, not mine. I have a feeling, too, that she wants her own Christmas tree ornaments to unbox annually, not her mother's. A very funny letter came from Buddy today, written just after he came off KP. I think of him as I write about Muriel. He would despise her for her marriage motives, as I put them down here, but are they despicable? In a way, they must be, but yet they seem to me so human-sized and beautiful that I can't think of them even now as I write this without feeling deeply, deeply moved. He would disapprove of Muriel's mothers, too. She's an irritating, opinionated woman, a type Buddy can't stand. I don't think he could see her for what she is, a person deprived for life of any understanding or taste for the main current of poetry that flows through things, through all things. She might as well be dead, and yet she goes on living, stopping off at delicatessens, seeing her analysts, consuming a novel every night, putting on her girdle, plotting for Muriel's health and prosperity. I love her. I find her unimaginably brave. Oh, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next week for the final part of this story by J.D. Salinger. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.